Welcome to Post Carbon Radio. I'm your host, Bing Gong. Karin Nyhaus, my regular co-host, is on another interview assignment, and filling in for her today is my wife, Eleanor Espina. Thank you for joining me today, Eleanor.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
There is no doubt that the impacts of catastrophic climate change are upon us, if you read the headlines. Forest fires in Alberta, Canada, flooding in Europe, melting glaciers, islands disappearing, heat waves globally, mass extinctions, and devastated ecosystems. 197 nations of the world have been working on a global agreement annually for 21 years, while carbon emissions continue to increase. The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, COP21 Conference of the Parties, met in Paris last December. We've heard some reports that it was a fraud, a charade, and some are celebrating, declaring that it was a breakthrough. Today, we talk to Tom Athanasiou again, Executive Director of Eco-Equity, a small activist think tank that has an outside impact on the global climate equity debate. He calls himself a climate equity specialist. As a writer, he is the author of Divided Planet, The Ecology of Rich and Poor, and the co-author of Dead Heat, Global Justice and Global Warming, and Greenhouse Development Rights, The Right to Development in a Climate-Constrained World. He's been studying this issue for many years and is a longtime active and veteran of many UN climate negotiations, incredibly knowledgeable about what's happening on the inside of the UN negotiations. He is also working with a coalition of NGOs, civil society organizations, pushing on the outside for more ambition in the national pledges. Tom will give us his insights into whether Paris COP21 was a success or a failure. Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Tom.
Glad to be here, Bing.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Eleanor, right?
Yeah, that's right, a fellow Greek. Tom, I'm going to ask the first question. Could you start by summarizing your work, the nature of your work in the climate arena, and how you came to the work in the first place?
Sure. I have a one-line summary of my project, which is that I'm interested in understanding and advocating for a climate treaty that's fair enough to actually work. And my principal interests are have to do with distributive justice in a finite world. I do not believe that the climate crisis and the environmental crisis more generally can be separated from the crisis of injustice and inequality. I believe that they are two sides of one coin. I mean, this used to be a kind of outlier position, but, you know, this being the year of Bernie, it no longer really is. But there's a lot more work to do to figure out exactly what it means and what it implies.
Well, let's, for some of our guests that are new to this issue, just what is climate justice? And you might talk about historical responsibility.
Yeah, I could talk about historical responsibility, and I will. But more simply, it's that the crisis is coming over us in a situation where our society is profoundly divided between the rich and the poor. And historically, the development process by which people got ahead has had a lot to do with the burning of fossil fuels. And so the question is, how do we go on from here, eliminating fossil fuels, keeping it in the ground, while at the same time providing development paths, just and sustainable development paths for everyone? And in that context, historical responsibility is a very, very major equity consideration, equity principle. It's not the only one. The big four, when it comes to equity principles that are relevant, are responsibility, which you just mentioned, capacity, the ability to act, need, and there's a tremendous amount of need, and also adaptation need, because people are going to get hit really hard, as well as the need for assistance in transitioning, and equality, human rights, you know, equal rights. What do we have? What do we owe each other? These are the big equity principles, and the question are how we navigate the transition in a way that is fair enough, as the Australians say, so that we can move very, very rapidly. Basically, you know, there's an agreement, a rough and ready agreement, but one that's getting clearer every year, that we basically have to phase out fossil fuels by the middle of the century. And the thing you have to realize about this is that while it's technologically possible, it will be fantastically difficult. And so though that's basically the problem that I'm interested in. That's my hobby, if you will.
Okay, let's get to what happened in Paris, Tom.
In my opinion, Paris was a breakthrough, but not a success. It's a breakthrough because it put an end to a battle between the North and the South that, as it was set up, was never going to be resolved. So each year was just going to be another wasted year.
You're referring to the Kyoto Protocols, I assume.
The Kyoto Protocol, but also a literal-minded interpretation of the Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was agreed in 1992 in Rio at the Earth Summit, right? And the idea was that the rich countries would move first, and then the developing countries would follow them, and it was good in theory, but it was very, very easy for the fossil cartel and the forces of do-nothingness to block. What we have now after Paris is an agreement to a universal accord that involves all countries. And this raises all kinds of fascinating and interesting problems, but it also spotlights the equity question in a way that allows for some progress to be made and gets us past what the binary divide between the North and the South, so that we can talk about equity in a more complex way. You got to remember, just to explain what I mean by more complex, is that both the United States and China are very, very starkly and brutally divided internally between rich and poor populations. And so that's basically a picture of the world that we have to deal with. And hopefully now we've got a universal treaty. There's a lot of battles in the future, but hopefully they're better kinds of battles than it was possible to fight before Paris.
Tom, I have a couple questions arising from your use of the term agreement to a universal accord. I understand, for one thing, the accord is not legally binding, and for another, the commitments are self-made. Can you talk about those two things?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. On the question of legal bindingness, one thing I want to say about this is that a lot of the people who have criticized the Paris deal from the left have trotted this one out and said, you know, it's useless, it's not legally binding. And my only response to that is, well, there's no world government. Right? What would it mean for a climate agreement to be legally binding? You have to remember that Canada agreed to the Kyoto Protocol, and it It even ratified the Kyoto Protocol, and then it walked away from it when there was a change of government, and there were absolutely no political consequences for the government of Canada in doing so. So, it would be nice to have a legally binding accord. It would be nice to have a top-down, so-called, accord in which the governments sat down and used rational discourse and moral logic to divide up the very small remaining carbon budget and to figure out who should do what. But none of that was going to happen.
That would be a top-down approach.
That would be a top-down approach. What we have, you have to remember that this planet is in the midst of a huge governance crisis. So in that context, how do you move? How do you move? You face the reality that this is a world of nation states. You say that countries are going to each come up with their pledges of what they're willing to do based on their own domestic political battles, their own domestic political contexts. And then somehow there's going to be another layer of negotiation and adjudication on top of that to determine whether that the pledges add up to enough to stabilize the climate system, and they do not add up. The first round of pledges is far too weak. And then to ask the question, how are we going to strengthen the pledges, and how are we going to cooperate to come up with a set of pledges that is strong enough to stabilize the climate system? And in that process, we're going to be developing what is, in effect, a prototype of a global governance regime, but we don't have one to begin with. So that's basically the problem.
Could you just bottom up? Sorry. Yeah, if you could just clarify that term, the bottom-up agreement versus the top-down, and make clear to our listeners which Paris is.
Yeah, Paris is bottom-up. Paris is each country makes its own pledge. And then in the international negotiations, those pledges are added up, they're evaluated, they're negotiated, they're hopefully strengthened, and as opposed to a top-down deal would be, you know, if you imagine some hypothetical, well-functioning United Nations system where we could just figure out what the fair shares were and assign them to countries. But, you know, that wouldn't happen in practice, right? Any kind of deal that was made at the UN level that told the United States what its fair share was, first of all, it would be very small compared to what U.S. emissions are today, right? And then what would we have? We would have the Republicans and the fossil cartel and the tobacco companies and the forces of do nothingness in general just snookering the deal, right? But if it's a bottom up deal, then presumably the country that makes the offer has some sort of ownership. The national campaigners have some traction. We can, you know, that's the idea. The idea is you start with what you have, which is a governance system based on nations, and you try to put together a layer on top of that, a negotiations layer on top of that that will, and that's where that the interesting thing about this, the thing that's most fascinating about this, is if you admit political reality that this is a world of states and that there is no global governance, and then you ask yourself the question, how are we going to strengthen these inadequate national pledges? Then you're smack up against the equity problem, which is, you know, say in the United States, we make a pledge, we have made a pledge, it's completely inadequate. How do we talk about that? How do we understand what we have pledged to do relative to what we should be pledging to do if we were to do our fair share? And that's a conversation we have to have in the United States and in every other country.
Let me just do a quick thing here, Tom. You're listening to Post Carbon Radio with Bing Guang and Eleanor Thespina, and our guest today, Tom Athanasiou of Eco Equity. So the gigaton gap, Tom, I think plays right into what you're talking about right there. Can you tell us a little about that and how big it is?
And I think at the same time, you might mention the carbon budget.
Mm-hmm. So this is basically two words for the same thing. The problem is that the gigaton gap is the gap between the pledges that have been made, you know, all the pledges that were made by all the nations of the world prior to Paris, and how much they add up to in terms of emissions reductions going forward, that on the one hand, and on the other hand, what needs to be done in order to draw down global carbon emissions to the point where that we stabilize the climate system, and that very, very unforgiving necessity is dictated by what the scientists call the carbon budget. And it's necessary for people to understand just how small the remaining carbon budget is, just how deep into overshoot we are right now. We've been debating this for several decades, but we finally got some numbers from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in late 2015 with the fifth assessment report of the IPCC, and we won't really have firm numbers for the temperature target of 1.5 degrees until 2018. But based on the numbers we think we have now, at current emissions globally, we're going to burn through the remaining carbon budget in 4 to 8 years. So the nations of the world agreed in Paris to hold the temperature change to a maximum of 1.5 degrees centigrade, and that means that we have a certain number of tons, a certain number of gigatons, actually, that we can emit globally between now and, say, 2100. And we're going to, at current rates, absolutely, within 10 years, we will have used up the rest of the remaining budget. So the gigaton gap is absolutely huge.
I've heard that we're pretty close to the 1.5 degree mark right now.
In what sense?
Well, just recently, actually, when we were in France, there was talk of being, you know, that target is much closer than we think, because the rate of increase, even just the first months of this year, seems, again, to be higher than predicted.
Oh, yeah, it's really, really bad. I mean, the last 11 months have all been temperature records, and we are now above 1 degree centigrade, and there's a lot of latency in the system, a lot of momentum in the system. Holding the 1.5 degree line would be about the hardest thing we ever did.
Mm-hmm.
That is absolutely true. We are very, very seriously in trouble. And yet, in Paris, the nations of the world agreed to attempt to hold the 1.5 degree line. Now, you can be cynical about that, and you can say that it was just some, you know, greenwashing, or you could say that it represented an aspirational goal that gives us, the people of the world, a tool by which to hold our leaders to account. And, you know, I choose, and many, many people in the climate movement choose to interpret it in that way. Do I think we're going to be able to hold the 1.5 degree target? Actually, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
But do I think that trying our best to hold the 1.5 degree target will give us a decent chance of holding the warming below 2 degrees? Yes, I do. And do I think we will be able to hold the warming to 2 degrees if we don't try our best for 1.5? No, I don't. Mm-hmm. So it's a situation like that, right? And 2 degrees, we could still manage 2 degrees. It would be incredibly difficult. There will be incredible suffering, incredible destruction, but we could probably manage it if we're in a high cooperation world. If we can't get into a high cooperation world, we won't make it in any case.
Mm-hmm. Tom, you've been following what's happening inside the negotiations, but you're also connected with global climate equity groups, NGOs, and civil society organizations. Can you tell us a little bit about that project you're working with these groups?
Yes. What we did before Paris was we formed a coalition of organizations to review the first batch of pledges, the pre-Paris pledges, and we have about 150 organizations signed on, and some of them are large and some of them are small. I mean, we have Friends of the Earth, Oxfam, World Wildlife Fund, Christian Aid, CARE International, APRADEV, which is a network of church-based development organizations, the Climate Action Network, many of the continental nodes of the Climate Action Network, and we also have a lot of small organizations and organizations that are based in the developing world, you know, like the Jubilee Network and the Third World Network. And the idea was to come up with a big tent of civil society organizations that could review the national pledges on the basis of equity principles. Who is and who is not proposing to do their fair share? Those equity principles, I mentioned them before, they come down to responsibility, capability, need, and equality. You know, it was a very important climate justice report. It's called, you can find it on the web now, it's called Civil Society Equity Review of INDCs. The pledges are called INDCs in the formal language. And you can go to the Climate Equity Reference Project, and you will find a link to it. You can go to ecoequity.org, and you will find a link to it. The first major post-Paris negotiating session, which just occurred in May in Bonn, Germany, many of us got together and had a follow-up meeting, and we've decided we're going to carry the civil society equity review forward. And that's important because there are now a series of very high-level annual studies coming out that we can watch in terms of the evolving situation. There's the Gigaton Gap Report, which you mentioned, which comes out annually. There's the IPCC's flagship assessment report, which comes out every 5 years. There's the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Its secretariat reviews the pledges every year. And what we want to do, what we've decided to do, is add a civil society report to this mix of reports that comes out every year. And this will be the only one which is based, that does its assessment based on a fair shares analysis of the pledges. Mm-hmm. Rather than simply a science-based analysis of the pledges. And so we've decided to go for it and to try to have another version of the report done for COP22 this November in Marrakesh. We're trying to raise money to do it. It's not easy. The funders are all confused about what they want to do after Paris, but we've decided to do it, and it's important to do it because the countries themselves are not capable of doing an equity assessment of their own pledges. They're all bound up in all kinds of bargaining processes and political processes, which are understandable because it's a very the transition is very, very difficult. But what we're saying is that civil society can help here. Civil society can do something that the nations themselves cannot do. We can try to organize a conversation about fair shares and emergency mobilization that is outside the context of the formal negotiations and able to assist the formal negotiations by setting up a coherent conversation about fair shares, which then can bleed into the formal negotiations and actually help grease the wheels of action going forward. That's basically the idea.
Tom, we're going to take a short break and get back to our conversation. So back to Post Carbon, we're talking to Tom Athanasiou, Executive Director of Eco Equity, and we're talking about COP21 in Paris. Let's see, I think we were just talking about how the NGOs and civil society organizations are going to push on the outside to increase the ambition of all the nations. And tell us about the tool you're using, the Climate Equity Reference Calculator.
Right. So myself and some partners of mine, mostly at the Stockholm Environment Institute, have been working on a fair shares calculator for several years now, and it's a first approximation of the kind of fair shares modeling that we believe is going to be necessary in the next, absolutely necessary in the next couple of decades. And you can find the calculator online by going to the Climate Equity Reference Project. And you can play with it, and the important thing about it is that it doesn't tell you what climate equity means, because there's no agreement about what climate equity means. That's exactly the situation. What it does is it allows you to define it for yourself by saying, you know, what you think. Which you know, how stringent you think the carbon budget should be interpreted to be, how you would like to balance the principle of historical responsibility against the principle of national capacity, how you would like to take intranational inequality, that is to say inequality within nations, into account when you calculate national capacity, and on the basis of this, these kind of small number of very simple questions like this, it gives you a projection of what your nation would have to do in the context of the carbon budget you chose in order to do its fair share as you defined equity.
That's very interesting. So the parameters really are not built into the system. It's a flexible calculator.
Right. I mean, yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And this is super important, because the problem is that we don't have an agreement about what fair shares mean. So what we're trying to do is create a more organized public conversation about fair shares, one that's rooted in the science,
mm-hmm.
so you know, we're going to divide up the remaining carbon budget. Well, there's not enough carbon budget to divide up in any kind of a way that provides for the just and sustainable development of all the poor people on the planet. So there's going to have to be a come-to-Jesus moment, if you will, where we realize that if we're going to stabilize the climate system, if we're going to create a high cooperation world, there's going to have to be a reckoning with the problem of redistribution. And And what we're saying is that that reckoning can begin with the energy system itself. We can, if we're going to make a high ambition climate transition, we're going to have to build a 100% renewables energy system. We're going to have to build it globally, and we're going to have to build it fast. And that's not going to be cheap, and it's not going to be easy. So how are we going to pay for it? That's what it means in practice to think about fair shares within the context of the extremely constrained global carbon budget. And so, you know, you can decide how progressive you want the definition of a national economic capacity to be. The calculator, the calculator allows you to basically define a flat tax, or it allows you to say, actually, I think the richest 5% of the people on the planet should pay for the entire transition. You can just set that up very easily, and you'll get some numbers back, and they're very challenging numbers, but they certainly don't constitute a price that cannot be paid. One other thing about this is that I want to make the high level point. I want to make it very clearly. The high level point is that we are not doomed. We have the money, and we have the technology to save ourselves. But we still have to do so. We still have to save ourselves. It's not going to happen by itself. The technology itself is not going to save us. And that means that we have to mobilize our capacity to act, and we have to do it globally. This is what I mean by a high cooperation world. And we all know that we're not in a high cooperation storyline right now. We all know this. And what we're saying is that this is the definitional story of the human future. How we engage with this crisis is going to determine how we deal with the choices that are before us. And we can do this. You know, it's only going to cost, if you want to reduce it to the most ridiculous kind of reductionist economics, it's only going to cost about $500 billion a year for, say, 50 years to save human civilization. Say it cost $1 trillion. Say it was really, really expensive. Say it cost $1 trillion a year for 50 years to stabilize the climate system, stabilize the human economy, and save human civilization. Would it be worth it? You know, you decide. You know what I mean?
But, well, in a high cooperation world, it might not be difficult to find that money. But in the governance crisis that we're in right now, you know, with all the dissent and disagreement, then you know, we're spending all our money on that disagreement.
Exactly.
And difficulty.
But what if most likely that's what we're going to continue to do, right? But what if we don't, right? What if the focused necessity of climate stabilization gets us onto the same page? What if we can actually decide we're going to, what if we actually decide we're going to deal? I mean, the climate crisis is different than, say, the crisis of world hunger, right? I mean, if people are starving thousands of miles away and they're not on television, you can pretty much forget about them,
yeah.
Right? But this is different. This is different. This is the atmospheric system itself that needs to be stabilized. And if we don't leapfrog into a global clean energy economy, then people are going to continue to use coal, and they're going to continue to use oil, and they're going to continue to deforest the planet, etc. Blah blah blah. You know, so we really are the climate crisis really does force us, perhaps against our will, to recognize the fact that we're in this together, and that's why that's one of the reasons why it can be seen as a source of hope. We have to deal with this, and if we deal with this in a way that creates the capacity for trust and cooperation as part of the mobilization to leapfrog to 100% renewables, then that trust and cooperation can then allow us to deal with the agricultural crisis as well, right? And the crisis of land use and building inhabitable cities and sustainable cities. And we can leverage the climate transition to deal with the larger problems as well. We haven't got any choice.
How do you see the civil society groups using the equity reference calculator to bring about the change that we need?
That's a good question. Think, and this is a really good it's a really good opportunity to talk about why the advantages of having a bottom up model of the transition sort of outweigh the disadvantages of not having a top down legally binding regime, which we don't have anyway. But in a bottom up world, right, which is the one we're in, every country has to make its own low-carbon transition plan. And in fact, the Paris Agreement, Article 14, Paragraph 9, Article 4, Paragraph 19, invites all countries to produce a low-carbon transition plan or a deep decarbonization transition plan, depending on how you want to talk about it. So say you're in country X. Right. Let's say you're in the United States, but it could be Indonesia, or it could be Germany, or it could be Brazil, or it could be South Africa. In every country, the national community of academics and scientists and civil society campaigners and citizens, and youth activists need to have an engagement and come up with a plan. And in every country, civil society needs to campaign to make that plan as ambitious and as fair as possible. So in every country, national civil society and national campaigners and national scientists and national philosophers and national artists need to engage with each other to define a national transition plan which is consistent with the overall climate budget, which is very, very challengingly small. And then at the level of the international negotiations, those plans need to be compared, and people need to be able to say who's offering to do their fair share, and how do you define fair share? And no, I don't think that's a really good way to define fair share. I think we should define fair share this way. But however we do it, we all have to act. Let's get moving. By the way, what about those people over there, like, say, the Russians, for example? What if we decided the Russians weren't doing their fair share, or the Saudis weren't doing their fair share, or the Venezuelans weren't doing their fair share? How are we going to deal with that? That's a huge challenge, but at least it's a comprehensible framework, right, that involves engaged civil society, an international discussion, national planning at every level, an international process in which people are invited to think about how to compare national plans to each other. And, you know, none of this is going to work unless there's a vast and powerful grassroots movement, which is simultaneously campaigning for economic and social justice and for keeping the fossils in the ground. And that is coming up at the same time. And by no means am I arguing that this highfalutin international, formal, science-based process should in any way be a substitute for the grassroots mobilization. What I'm saying is that the grassroots mobilization is not enough, that we need to be talking about a simultaneous mobilization at the grassroots to keep the coal in the hole, and at the same time a multi-tiered, extremely complex, extremely sophisticated intergovernmental science-based process to figure out how we're going to make the transition into a post-carbon world in which people are not trapped in poverty and desperation, because otherwise it's not going to happen.
You're listening to Post-Carbon Radio with Tom Athanaskew of Echo Equity. Tom, can you explain the roadmap of the next coming UN climate negotiations? I think you said there was going to be a next big moment.
Oh, yeah, that's a really good question. I'm really glad you asked that question. So think about the big picture, right? We had, in 1992, we had the Earth Summit, and we got the Framework Convention. In 1997, we got the Kyoto Protocol, and things went to hell. In 2009, in Copenhagen, there was the big reorientation began, and it was tremendously traumatic, and everybody interpreted it as a failure. And then in 2015, we had what I'm calling a tentative breakthrough in Paris. That's by no means the end of it, right? One of the reasons why the Paris Agreement is structured to support the transition is that the negotiations are never going to end. The negotiations are now going forward on a five-year cycle. Every 5 years, the IPCC is going to do an assessment report. And every 5 years, there's going to be a new round of national pledges to try to bring the national transition plans into accord with the scientific limits as we understand them. Moving targets every 5 years. That means there's a review, a formal review process every 5 years, a formal review of the pledges that are on the table. Now, the next really big formal review is called the Global Stocktake. It's actually the first really big global review is scheduled for 2023, and it's called the Global Stocktake. But it's a five-year cycle. That means 5 years before 2023, in 2018, is the 2018 Stocktake, or the more formally known as the 2018 Facilitative Dialogue. That's going to be the next big political moment, the political moment that follows Paris. So Paris was 2015, and 2018 is going to be the 2018 Stocktake. It's very important because the Paris Agreement actually goes into effect in 2020. 2018 is the last opportunity we have to increase the ambition of the pledges before the Paris Agreement actually goes into effect. The IPCC is going to do a special report in 2018 on the 1.5-degree pathway, and that's going to add fuel to the fire. It's going to make people realize how important this is, and what's necessary is that we have a really massive global mobilization for 2018, that we make the climate movement everywhere on the planet does everything that it can to make the 2018 breakthrough the next big breakthrough after Paris, rather than spending the next couple of years in this absolutely pointless conversation about whether Paris was a failure or not, to agree that it was a partial breakthrough and that we need another one, and that the next moment is 2018, and we have to make it work. We have to make it work at the level of the grassroots, and we have to make it work at the level of the national decarbonization plans, and we need to make it work at the level of the equity debate about how we're going to understand what countries are proposing to do enough, and how we're going to cooperate internationally, how we're going to share technology between rich countries and poor countries, and how we're going to share finance. How maybe we need to have a Robin Hood tax, maybe tax on foreign transactions. that so that we can pump some billions of dollars into the Green Carbon Fund, so, you know, and blah, 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 blah. There's a million things to talk about, but 2018 is the next big moment.
We talked recently about the how will we achieve it question, 1.5 being such a challenging target, and we were talking about objections to nuclear and space mirrors and geoengineering, tree plantations, and we said there were costs and risk to all of these. Can you talk some about what we need to do? How are we going to reach agreement?
Yeah, I don't know how we're going to reach agreement, but I can tell you that if we don't reach agreement, that the kinds of geoengineering solutions that you're talking about are going to be accepted by large fractions of the population because people will be desperate.
Yeah.
And you know, if we don't have a really vibrant and powerful grassroots movement, if we don't have a really convincing solar revolution, and if we don't have the beginnings of a viable global treaty architecture, people are going to despair. You know, we need to loop back around on the good news, right?
Mm-hmm.
The good news, and it is incredibly good news, is that the solar revolution is real. You know, I've spent decades waiting for the solar revolution, right? And I think many of us have. But it's finally happening this time. If you read any of the really good stuff, like Jeremy Leggett's blog, for example, the winning of the carbon war, and you understand what's happening at the level of batteries, and what's happening at the level of electric vehicles, and what's happening at the level of wind and geothermal, and especially what's happening with core solar voltaic technology. It gives us a place to stand. But what we have to remember is that it's not enough. Nuclear is this whole rat hole conversation, and what I would rather say about it is, look, it's expensive, it's dangerous. You know, if it was necessary, we would have to do it, but it isn't necessary. Let's do what we know we can do that is more cost effective. If we have to have a technical debate about whether or not nuclear can be done, you know, cheaply enough to be relevant, and which of course Jim Hansen would like to have that conversation, you know, 24/7. But you know, let's talk about that conversation after drinks while we've spent the day working on the solar build out, because the solar build out, we know we can do that, and you know, and it's going to happen anyway. So space mirrors are a really stupid idea. The problem of sequestration of carbon is absolutely one that we can't avoid. But again, let's do the first thing first. Let's reforest the planet. And we'll get a win out of reforestation on a global scale. It will put millions of people to work. It will be great for the animals. It will be great for the biomes. It will be great for agroecology and the rebuilding of the food system. Let's do all that stuff first. And then, you know, and if that isn't enough and we have to come up with some technology for sucking carbon dioxide out of the air, maybe we can come up with a way of doing that isn't too dangerous, or maybe isn't dangerous at all. I mean, there seems to have been a breakthrough on, believe it or not, baking soda. The Finns think they've made a breakthrough for using massive amounts of baking soda to bind carbon and then pump it into underground caves. That might not be so bad. I don't know, right? I haven't had a chance to look at it. It's just breaking news that's been in the science press for the last couple of weeks. There are a lot of things to do. but some of them are dangerous and super expensive. It would suck all the money out of the system, right? Even if nuclear was safe, it would be so expensive, we wouldn't have money to do anything else.
Yeah.
Tom, we're going to have to wrap it up, but before we do, give us your website for Echo Equity and how folks can find out more about the Global Climate Equity Reference Project.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. My website is Echo Equity, by coincidence.
.org.
EchoEquity.org, and if you go there, you will find the TED Talk I just did last November, and you will find a link to the Carbon Equity Reference Project, and you will find a link to the Civil Society Equity Review.
Thank you so much for your
insight into
what's happening in the UN climate negotiations.
I hope that was useful, Bing. Thank
yes, you. Very useful. Mm-hmm.
So we're going to close out. You can listen to all our archive programs at wmpostcarbon.com. That's WM for West Marin, wmpostcarbon.com. Thanks for joining us today. Stay tuned for Cruisin' with Rick Clark.
Thanks, Bing.
Thank you, Tom.
Bye-bye.
Eleanor.
I'm trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause Earth is calling. I was 10 years old, exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is still rising from the pollution we produce. We need to start striving for a solution to reduce. When we burn fossil fuels like coal and gasoline, we're using dirty energies when we should be using clean. When we burn, we're adding to the greenhouse effect. CO2, CH4, and N2O collect in our atmosphere. They remain up there for years and years, absorbing sun rays that come near. But we need to persevere, cause this makes our planet's temp rise fast. So why can't we find a way to cut back on our greenhouse gas?
We have waited too long. Act now before the moment's gone. The situation's tough, but stay strong until we see the dawn.
The climate's on my mind, climate's on my mind. Climate's on my mind, climate's on my mind. The climate's on my mind, climate's on my mind. The climate's on my mind, climate's on my mind.
The most abundant greenhouse gas is carbon dioxide, beats a methane, nitrous oxide, and the F gases by landslide. Everyone releases it when they drive, unless you have...